This is the TACT podcast, and I'm Jen Saderhelm. TACT is about sex, sexual health, our bodies, identities, and mental health. It will contain sensitive content, and the material presented here is for general information purposes only. You can find support links and further information in the show notes. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we are recording on. We respect their cultural heritage, beliefs, and relationship to country, and extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that are listening today. This episode is being an advocate for yourself. Being an advocate for yourself means feeling or being able to voice your concerns in seeking appropriate healthcare, access health information, resolve health issues, or identify available treatment options. Advocacy can protect your rights, ensure you are heard, and prevent discrimination against you. So, what are your healthcare rights? In Australia, young people from the age of 16 years have the same right to consent to healthcare treatment as adults. Healthcare rights ensure all patients and carers in Australia receive safe, high-quality care in partnership with healthcare providers. Australians' healthcare rights are set out in the Australian Charter of Healthcare Rights. These rights apply to any healthcare you receive anywhere in Australia, including in public hospitals, private hospitals, general practice, and in the community. I'd like to introduce my guest for this Being an Advocate for Yourself episode, my TACT collaborator and friend, Jodie Kirkness. Jodie is a journalist who works for Women's Health Matters. At age 17, Jodie was diagnosed with a high-grade malignant Fallopian tumour. The diagnosis was almost accidentally discovered and resulted in 5 weeks of radiation and a radical mastectomy. 3 years later, Jodie had a chest reconstruction. While all this happened, Jodie finished year 12, played high-level soccer, and tried to continue living a normal teenage life. She chose not to tell people what she was going through, not her teachers, not most of her friends, family, and sporting team members. Now at 24, Jodie has become a passionate health advocate for others and for herself, saying no one else is going to do it for you. Hi, Jodie.
Hi, Jen.
So I was thinking in the car about the whole, when you have a significant health issue, no matter what age you're at, I think we fall into two camps. There's the people who openly will discuss their health journey and the people who like to keep it to themselves. And initially I was sitting there thinking that part of being an advocate for yourself is sharing that journey. But part of this discussion is that you can still be an advocate for yourself while keeping your health journey private. I suppose we're sort of 7 years on from the start of this now. What are your feelings now about how you approached telling people or not telling people about your diagnosis?
I suppose I was very private with my diagnosis, so I didn't really tell anyone what I was going through unless it was on a need-to-know basis, I suppose. I guess looking back on that now, it probably would have been better for me had I have spoken to people, so, you know, like teachers, coaches, that sort of stuff. I think no matter what your age, it can be very daunting to tell anyone when it first happens. Yeah, so I guess that was my approach then. My approach now would sort of be like still tell who you need to know, but if you can tell them sooner, that'll probably work out a little bit better for you in the long term.
I imagine that you went to most of your doctor's appointments and so on with family members?
Yes, that's correct. I went to most of them with my mum.
Did you ever have some of those moments where you just sort of thought, this doctor's not for me, or this place is not for me? Did that sort of thing?
I guess when I was first diagnosed, without naming names, the doctor I had, she kind of said to me after my diagnosis that, you know, like I've looked it up on the internet and 9 times out of 10 Fallopian tumours aren't malignant, but we'll send you to a specialist anyway. So I guess that kind of gave me a bit of false hope. And then when I went to the specialist, they were like, no, like this needs to be removed like immediately. So then the specialist that I did see, he was very good in the sense that he was like, I don't feel comfortable doing this. What I'm going to do is refer you on to who taught me, essentially. So my mum and I flew up to Melbourne the next week for the mastectomy. Yeah, and then sort of snowballed from there, I guess.
I like that. I think when we go to see doctors or go to hospital or something like that, usually we don't know the process. That's not our area of expertise, etc. So I like that that doctor was open enough to say, I don't feel confident myself, so I feel like I should pass you on to someone who's better able to do it, which is more what I would like to see in the health profession, being able to discuss this a bit more openly without the jargon and with a bit more honesty.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think one of the main things for that doctor was perhaps we don't have the, I guess, tools needed in Canberra to do some of those surgeries, and because it had grown so radically, I guess, yeah, he was like, off you pop. yeah, but when I did go to Melbourne, I think, hands down, it's some of the best care I've had. Whilst most doctors don't have a great bedside matter when it comes to this, the one that I did have was quite good in the sense that he was like, hey, like, you need to get up, come for a walk, like, probably a week after my first surgery. So he was very good.
Yeah. You're 17. You weren't even able to vote by this stage of this. And yet at this age, 16, 17, you still know in your gut if something doesn't feel right. And I'm assuming also when you got your diagnosis, you went researching too to find out best information. Part of this podcast episode is discussions around that from 16, you can get your own Medicare card. You can go to the doctor by yourself. Did you feel able to speak of some of the things that you'd learnt or you were feeling or some of those bigger discussions around your diagnosis?
When I was first diagnosed?
Yeah.
I guess the short answer would be yes and no. So I guess because I was so embarrassed, inverted commas there, I didn't particularly want to ask those questions myself because it was the first child, I guess, to my mum as well that had had cancer. I don't think she was best placed to ask those questions for me either. So I think having very simple information on how to be your own health advocate available, that perhaps, I don't know, could be in GP's offices or something like that as well, you know, to bring along a notepad so you can take notes on what they're saying and also to write down a list of questions for what you did want to ask. When I did go to Melbourne, some of the social workers did say to me, like, a really good way to be your own advocate is to write down those questions because, as you mentioned before, sometimes they do get caught up in medical jargon, so it's really important to try to help wrap those specialists back around to what you actually wanted to ask. I guess as well it's quite difficult being that young because it's a bit, you know, like you don't really want to speak out of turn or whatever, I suppose. Probably not the right turn of phrase there. But just like, you know, having the confidence to say back to your doctor, hey, I didn't understand that. Can you please re-explain? I do think doing research, you know, around these things is super important, but there's also like the WebMD hole. Like you don't really want to go down that for, yeah. I guess, like some smaller things or like, you know, like if I get a headache, I'm like, what could cause my headache? And it's like, you have brain cancer. And it's like, no, I probably don't have that. So like there's a fine line between like how much you should research. So I think you do need to put quite a bit of faith in your health professional to give you the right answers. But there's also like the balancing act of actually pushing them to give you the right answers. A lot of what I got when I was that young and I got diagnosed was like, oh, you couldn't possibly have breast cancer, you're only 17. And I'd see that, for example, if I went to get my scans in Canberra or something like that, they'd think it was for my mum, not for me. And it would just be like super awkward, which made me not then want to ask additional questions.
Yeah. I think that part of the conversation is still really true because whenever I've gone to get a mammogram, they always give you, it's most likely that whatever you've got is not cancer. And they do that, I think, to try and give you that sense of security about the process, etc. What would be a better way of approaching something like that with being, if they see something and they are concerned, not, as you said, giving that false hope?
I guess maybe like it's a bit of a balancing act because you don't want to scare someone and be like, you've got cancer before you've looked at the scan sort of thing. But it's also, I don't know, going back to that breast cancer example, like, you know, breast cancer is probably the most diagnosed cancer in Australia. like overall for both genders, whatever. So saying something like that when someone's already concerned kind of, I guess, not belittles them, but makes them then feel like they can't ask further questions. So I think probably just been quite upfront at the beginning, like, look, this is what we know, we're going to do the scan, you know, it may not be breast cancer, it may be, but just giving them, I guess, that security blanket of knowing that they've done the right thing by coming in to get a mammogram, for example, or yep. doing that. Because I think, you know, when people are constantly hearing that it's probably not this, it kind of makes them feel like they shouldn't go to the doctor if they think something's wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm a big advocate for if you think something's wrong, you know your body best. So go to a GP or whoever your health professional is.
We might pause the interview here to talk about the 7 basic healthcare rights. They are access, you have a right to healthcare services and treatment that meets your needs. Safety, you have a right to receive safe and high quality healthcare that meets national standards and to be cared for in an environment that is safe and makes you feel safe. Respect, you have a right to be treated as an individual and with dignity and respect. Your culture, identity, beliefs, and choices must be recognised and respected. Partnership. You have a right to ask questions and be involved in open and honest communication. You can make decisions with your healthcare provider to the extent that you choose and are able to your actions, and you may include the people that you want in that planning and decision making. Information. You have a right to receive clear information about your condition and health, as well as the possible benefits and risks of different tests and treatments, so you can give your informed consent. You can and should receive information about services, waiting time, and costs, and be given assistance when you need it to help you understand and use that health information. You also have the right to access your health information. You must be told if something's gone wrong during your healthcare, including how it happened, how it may affect you, and what is being done to make your care safe. Privacy. You have a right to have your personal privacy respected. Information about you and your health must be kept secure and confidential. Give feedback. You have a right to provide feedback or make a complaint without it affecting the way that you are treated. Your concerns should be addressed in a transparent and timely way, and you have the right to share your experience and to participate in the improvement of the quality of care and health services. Exercising your right to communication means it is more likely that you will understand and receive the best possible care and health outcome. Therefore, knowing and understanding your healthcare rights mean you can help the health system to help you. Some other key information. If you're an Australian citizen, you're eligible to apply for your own Medicare card separate from your parents from age 16. This means you are entitled to free or subsidised healthcare in hospital and from general practitioners and specialists. You're entitled to free treatment and accommodation as a public patient in a public hospital and to subsidised medicines through the Pharmaceutical Benefit Scheme, or PBS. Young people can also access a range of free or low-cost health services specifically for under 25-year-olds, including services for mental health and dental health, community health services, and support services if you have a disability. There are also free health services available for young asylum seekers and refugees if you don't have a Medicare card. Healthcare rights make sure everyone from different cultures and ways of life is treated with respect and dignity in the healthcare system. And now, back to the interview with Jodie. And that's part of your role now, is that you advocate to assist other people to do this. And I think we all spoke in this room about how it's easier sometimes to advocate for other people to do something than for yourself, which is quite a challenging concept in itself. I want to ask you about your friend Jess, because your friend Jess, you obviously shared this journey with, and she walked with you every step of the way. How, and I'm presuming Jess is your age too, how easy was it to have that discussion with her when you got the diagnosis?
Well, I guess Jess and I met, we worked at the same cafe when we were 17. We probably didn't hang out that much until I was 19. So in fact, I actually didn't tell her immediately. So I was taking my mum quite frequently with me to those appointments. And I remember when I did tell her, we were on a coast trip together and I was like, hey, by the way, you're going to see some scars like on my back and like on my front. She was like, why? Like, what's happened? And then I told her, and I think that was probably the first turnaround for me, because her reaction wasn't like, I don't want to say disgust, like that's one would react like that. But when you have that diagnosis, it like really affects your body image and stuff. So she was very, I guess, helpful with that and with other aspects. So I think, yeah, because I shared that sort of thing with her, she then shared with me, and then it sort of went from there. You know, she's only 2 years older than me. I think it would have been incredibly hard for her to see her friend go through something like that. But everything I've seen of Jess, like, from that is she's the kind of person that, like, gets it done. And I definitely think, like, carers have, like, a really hard role in that sense, because they don't want to, you know, show you if they're upset or anything. So they're just sort of, like, going through it alone as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So, yeah.
My own experience with breast cancer, it was my mother-in-law got a terminal diagnosis, and she actually lived, she was given 6 months but lived another decade afterwards. And she was really big on the, and I had not dealt with anyone in my immediate life who'd had cancer up until this point, but she was really big on the advocating for herself in terms of sharing every step of the way just as part of normal conversation. And while it didn't alleviate the fear and the scariness of some of the things that I witnessed as part of that journey, it helped. And like, it helped with the little things of that. In the first part, she actually made me feel her lump, and she said, this is what it feels like. It's really important to me that you know what it feels like. And I've never forgotten that, because it was just always all the treatment, all the nasty symptoms, all of that was part of our regular conversation, even though it was hard. And you're right with what you just said there, is when you're part of that journey, you want to help, but you don't know how, what you can really offer in terms of help other than sometimes just listening. If a person's struggling to support themselves, to advocate for themselves, as a friend of someone who you sit there and, like with your own friend, you sit there and think there's something going on, how can you approach this conversation?
I guess the biggest thing that I found is most people who are going through whatever it is in their own health journeys is they just want to be listened to. So I think coming at it from a way, like if you suspect something is wrong, going to them and being like, hey, like I noticed like this is happening, or like I've noticed you've been a bit down lately. I think the best way to do that, once you start that conversation, then is to actually listen to support them, not listen just to talk, or, you know, try to share your own experiences back, because although that can be super helpful down the track for that person, it's not necessarily the best thing, in my opinion, to do straight away, because it kind of makes them feel like they then need to support you back. So I think, yeah, when they're at the start of that journey, if you notice something's wrong, it's just been a listening ear and offering advice in a non-overwhelming way. So something that I found that my specialists in Melbourne were quite good at was that they would give me like one or two things I could do for a certain aspect of this thing, instead of overloading me with like, oh, you could try going to this place or this place or this place. It was more like specific things like, have you thought about contacting Canteen, for example, for support services? You know, like you should go to the physio, those sort of things to help deal with that.
And the other thing that you really validly pointed out to me is I would love sometimes to have taken a notepad to the doctors, but it feels like a weird thing to do. Do you know what I mean? It feels to me like almost like as a journalist, you're like taking notes in case you need them at a later date. But this is for ourselves. And when you're sitting there and you're in an environment where you don't know what's going on, you don't know what's happening, you don't know the diagnosis or whatever, it makes sense to bring that sort of thing. So if you were to see on a, and I think this is a great idea, on a doctor's wall, a list of ways of supporting yourself when you go to see a specialist or anywhere you are, besides bring your notepad and pen and taking notes, what other things can you do to just make that experience more easy?
One of the big things that I was told through my own cancer journey is to bring someone like to support you at the same time, because when you've been sort of, you know, a diagnosis or whatever has been put in your face, it kind of everything leaves your brain. You're just kind of like, oh, like, yeah. I don't know what to ask now. So it's really helpful to have someone with you in that case. So that does make it easier, and it does kind of, if you're a bit awkward about bringing the notepad, because it is a bit like odd to do that, having that extra person there with you to actually then be able to relay like key parts of that doctor's visit is super helpful, because then you can go back to the doctor and be like, actually, I didn't understand this at a later date.
Here's a checklist if you are seeking medical treatment on your own. 1. If you have a Medicare card, find a doctor who bulk bills and book an appointment. Bulk billing means there's no out-of-pocket fee for your medical service from health professionals, because they will bill Medicare directly and accepts the Medicare benefit as full payment for their service. 2. Ring your doctor to confirm you'll be attending without your parents if you're under 18, confirm you want the appointment kept private, and ask about payment options. 3. Attend the appointment. 4. Make sure you communicate openly with your doctor and listen to their advice. 5. Depending on the reason why you see your doctor, it might be a good idea to take some time after the appointment to think about your treatment options before you make any commitments. If you feel your rights have been denied or that you received poor care, you can make a complaint. It's a good idea to speak directly about your concerns to the health professional or service first before lodging a formal complaint with the health complaints organisation in your state or territory. Now, back to our interview. When it comes to your health, in so many things we're told to, you know, sleep on it and then come back to the decision. But in when it comes to your health, you've sometimes the doctor says we need to do this date. Can you sort of say, I need to just think on it for 24 hours? Would you recommend that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what their recommendation is, but I'm very strong advocate of if that recommendation that you've gotten from that particular doctor doesn't feel right, get a second opinion if you can. It really depends on what the situation is, but you can certainly say, like, I'm going to sleep on it for a night.
And in so many ways, being an advocate for yourself is about when something has happened that you feel you need to address, and there's many areas other than your health, and getting the ball rolling is the hardest part. And with your role with Women's Health Matters, that would be part of what you're also talking about, whether it be leaving a domestic violence situation or taking action on a workplace incident or something like that. When you just don't even know where to start in advocating for yourself, what places are there that women, people can go?
So we actually developed this fact sheet when we were going to the O Weeks a couple of weeks ago, and it's called When You Need Help for Your Health. So that's a very like general fact sheet of like what questions you can ask. You know, like what are some follow-up questions you can ask after they've given you your recommendation. But there are places in Canberra that you can go to get help for your health. I guess some of the things you need to consider around that is like cost. So you need to kind of take into account like what the cost of that is as one part of a bigger picture. So for example, you know, one place might bulk bill and that's all you can afford, but you might not necessarily be happy with that information you've gotten for that. So that's another factor to take into place. Can't really recommend any like specific areas that you can go to for help for your health, but you know, for example, if it's something to do with sexual health, you know, you could go to sexual health and family planning. You know, GPs are always a good first stop as well. There's the walk-in centres to get that initial sort of consult, I guess. I guess that's also when it comes back to doing a bit of research around what exactly it is you need, because you could, for example, go to a regular GP for something to do with like contraception or something like that, but it might actually be better to go to like a sexual health clinic for that. So it's taking those into account, and just back on the GP thing, if you see on their website, for example, that they specialise in women's health, you know, they might be a good option to go to as a starting point. It's very hard to like figure out where to go to from the start, and it makes it really hard to get the ball rolling. So yeah, just like a quick web search, I guess, as a starting point is never a bad idea.
And with doing that, part of the reason why also not starting is the confidentiality, you know, because you're worried that something you say is going to be passed on, and it's these are really intimate discussions, but of course, that's not what doctors are allowed to do.
Yeah, having that understanding that there is like a confidential agreement between you and your doctor. Of course, there are exceptions to that. For example, like if you're a danger to yourself or other people, don't quote me on that, but that's pretty standard, I think. But yeah, I guess in the end, they're there to help for a reason, and it should be a space where you do feel comfortable to talk openly and honestly about what it is you're going through.
Mm. So for yourself in your role now, if you're encountering your 17-year-old self after diagnosis, what would you say and what would you do differently?
I think the main thing that I would do differently would probably be a bit more open and honest about what I was going through. So for example, like I got my diagnosis and then I had my radiation and the wound wasn't healing particularly well. At the same time, I was also training to go to nationals for soccer, and I really didn't want to miss out on that at all. And then as luck would have it, I got quite sick with a cold before going and then flew to Perth, which only exasperated the issue, and then ended up having to go to hospital while I was there. So it was kind of a waste of my time anyway. But to loop that back around, I guess it would be to just like let people know what was going on and also take it easy on yourself, because there will be other opportunities to do stuff you want. I suppose the main thing in my experience and what I've heard from other cancer patients is you just want to keep going on as if everything's normal. And there is a reason why your doctors are telling you like, hey, you need to take it easy. Yeah, I guess some of the other things as well that I would tell 17-year-old Jodie is that like it's okay to be scared. I feel like I pushed down a lot of my emotions at the beginning, and still we're working on that. But like to just, you know, lean on the people around you because they do want to help. One of the things that I've learned about like having a cancer diagnosis is like the best thing about cancer is the people who come to support you, but it's also the worst thing about having cancer, because you end up kind of internalizing a lot of your emotions because you don't want to freak them out or make them upset. But yeah, most of the time they do really want to help you. Yeah.
Just to finish this, because I think what you just said is really relevant, is that in internalizing things so as not to freak out other people, and when your carers are upset, you want to care for the carer. What are outlets to be able to release that so that you can process how you're feeling? And what outlets have you used?
Very little, to be honest. I'm working on that now. I am processing some of what I went through now. But I guess it would be, you know, taking recommendations to see psychologists. There are places in particular situations that will have psychologists who have a specialization in what you do need to process. I guess as well, like, I don't know, I found like an outlet for me to deal with my stress was soccer. So when that was taken away from me and I couldn't do it as well, or like not be in pain doing it, that was really hard. I think, I don't know, my situation is quite niche in the sense that all of my friends at the time were also 17. So it would have been like they would have dealt with it probably the exact same way I did and been very uncomfortable if I brought it up. But I guess connecting with other like-minded people or people who are going through a similar experience, I definitely didn't use services like Canteen enough or anything like that, because I just did not want to be like a part of that group, if that makes sense. Like looking back on it, that was very silly because I was a part of that group. Like I did have cancer. Yep. But yeah, just finding people who can support you and knowing that they want to. But yeah, I think it's hard with that because sometimes if they break down in tears, it gets a bit awkward for you because you're like, oh, like now you're crying. I didn't want to make you upset.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're helping the helper. This is your quote that I'm going to give back to you here. I think your own personal story is one of the most powerful things you can share with people going through a similar experience. And in this age of audio, one of the nice things about it is that you can share your story. And for people who are out there who are sitting there going, I don't know if there's anyone else who feels like I do or has gone through what I do, it gives them the chance to hear all that you've said and let them know that that's okay. So I really thank you for discussing this and talking about being an advocate for yourself, which is, I think, for all of us, a work in progress. Thank you, Jodie. You're listening to the TACT podcast, with this episode being an advocate for yourself. TACT is made possible thanks to a YWCA and Beyond Bank grant, and with the support of Sexual Health and Family Planning ACT and Women's Health Matters, the voice for women's health and wellbeing in the ACT. The series is produced in partnership with the OWL at the University of Canberra. You can share your thoughts, ideas and feedback by email, tactpodcast@gmail.com, or via the TACT Podcast Facebook page. Our theme song is Satisfied Minds by the fabulous Canberra band Moroji. If anything we've talked about has raised concerns for you, there are many free support services that you can reach out to for help. These details are in the show notes. Next time, we'll be talking about sex. Yep, sex in all its colours, flavours, recipes and applications. Till then, stay safe and well.